I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit.
Can't Lit. Talk about books and stuff.
Hello and welcome to Can't Lit. If you don't know what it is by now and this is your first episode, I mean, maybe I'm sorry that Jen and I are here.
We're not explaining. If you don't know, we're not explaining.
No. This is the literary podcast where we talk about books and stuff, but also celebrities, snacks, animals. There's a real versatility. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Dina.
I talked to Dad last night on FaceTime for 3 hours. I just wanted you to know.
Oh, what happened? Anything good?
He was telling me a lot of stories about trail. He's been just looking at a bunch of family stuff. So we talked a lot about that. I got to hear again about this guy who really drank himself to death. That's a popular story that I get to hear quite often.
For anyone who doesn't know, friends of the podcast, Dina's dad, Henry, is like my substitute dad. Yeah.
Joint dad. So we have an incredible guest today. Very, very special guest. We're really excited that he's here. He's a writer. He is a very good tweeter. Naben Rathnam. And he's the author of the new novel, A Hero of Our Time. It is out now with McClellan and Stewart. Yeah, and Jen and I were already raving about this book. So get excited to read this book and listen to this episode. Hello, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I should say we only have people on our podcast who have great hair. Naben has great hair.
It's true. Oh, thank you. So you are a part of this, club.
Wow, have you never had a bald on the show?
No, we've had bald, yes, but good bald, we have. But good bald head.
They have to accept it, shave their head, and have some sort of tonsure or something good.
Does anyone still do a comb over? I feel like it was really popular, and then it just kind of faded away. People did start to do the shave. There isn't as much of a comb over culture.
Well, that depends, because I feel like my ex-father-in-law and my current father-in-law both have comb overs. But yeah. They're 80.
Really?
Yeah, but okay, they're old.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. If you're in your 80s, I think the comb over is still happening. But I think, recent retirees, I think they're just going for the shave. I don't know.
It looks cool. It's a good way to go.
It does look cool. Yeah, I like it.
Even Prince William has kind of a shave now.
Yeah, he looks good, but it was, I mean, we can't all deny how disappointing it was generationally when he went bald. That was a real surprise to everybody, but it was also very cool that he just went bald. No.
Yeah.
Didn't make anything. He can't
compete with his brother and that head of hair.
Oh, Harry's got a donut though.
He does now? Oh, I haven't
noticed. Yeah, he's got if you ever watch the karaoke bit he did with James Corden, you can really see his donut.
Jen, come on. I'm not watching karaoke bits with James Corden.
Well, I do.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, I support you and I respect you, but I don't think I can get on that.
James Corden is in this one Mike Lee movie, and he's really good. It's the only time I haven't wished he was dead while he was on screen. I'm sure he's a lovely man. I'm sure he's a great guy.
I don't watch him for James Corden. I watch him because sometimes his karaoke's are really funny because of the guests. Like when he had all the Broadway musical people, like Lin-Manuel Miranda and all of the Broadway musical people on, they were great because they did a whole song from Les Mis. Do you hear the people sing? And it was fantastic. And when he had Prince Harry on, everyone knows I'm a royal junkie. So that was for Prince Harry. It's not for Corden, in my defense.
I love George Michael, and George Michael had a lot of fun with him, so I can't take that away from him.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there any Britney news before we move on?
The only thing that's new is I think she called her sister a scum again. That's the only new thing, which is good. Oh, I know what's happening. I did see about Britney that she is currently soliciting songwriters to make a new album. So that's exciting.
I love that for her.
I mean, that's what's happening.
About Yeah, speaking about what's happening with you, Jen?
I did watch The Tinder Swindler last night. That was fun.
Tell me about it.
Oh, it's on Netflix. It's like a true crime thing. He swindles this guy, Simon, swindles ladies on the interwebs with the Tinder. And the funny thing is about it is that he has to have all these women scamming all these women at one time because it's like a Ponzi scheme, right? Like one woman is supporting the lifestyle that he's living with another woman. And there's this whole thing. But I was watching it and I was really like, why am I not a Tinder swindler? This seems like a good line of work.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. And they kept sending him their passport information. And I'm like, why are you ladies doing this? Like, why would you send your passport information to anybody? Like, I don't understand. Oh, I need your passport so I can take this credit card out because for security reasons, I'm like being targeted and I can't have a credit card in my own name. So I need your passport information so I get a credit card in your name. And then I'm going to give you this check that's never going to get cashed. It's like, I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, he's not in prison anymore. He's out and apparently still swindling people. So this is fascinating.
That is new what's happening. Swindles.
Yeah, wow. He's on Instagram. He has his own Instagram. Still, everyone knows he's a swindler.
Jen, I don't
know. Who's falling for it? Who are they?
This is a lot.
Okay, anyway. Lot. What's happening with you, Dina?
I mean, it's nothing that fun. I feel like my hormones tried to destroy me this week, but I said, no, thank you. I will set many burning hot water bottles to my flesh. I will take muscle relaxants. I will drink hot toddies and watch television. I'm on day 7 and I feel like if it goes on much longer, I will have to perform a home hysterectomy. So that's what's happening.
Please don't do that. At least let me do it.
Yeah, you can come over. I'll throw some towels down. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
We'll just make it happen. I feel like that completely consumed just me personally, my week. So, I mean, it wasn't that fun. I did get some weird, ridiculous outfits in the mail that I ordered. So that was the positive part of my week. So I'm excited about, my dopamine purchases arriving. And just looking like a clown, which I like. So yeah, I'm excited about that. That part's good. Yeah. Ben, what is happening with you?
Started walking a lot. I keep on injuring my back and shoulders from walking because I'm in such terrible shape.
Really?
I don't know how there's like something under my shoulder blade. It doesn't work anymore because I've started to walk more than, you know, to the corner of the street once in a while. It's okay. It'll work itself out. I'm just walking through the pain, but it's been nice to, you know, move again. Pandemic stuff, of course, just kind of cut out all my usual little things that I used to do to not be an inert lump. And I'm enjoying, you know, faking going back to that.
Do you do anything while you're walking? Like, are you quiet? Are you listening to music? Do you listen to a podcast?
Music usually, but also for the first time in forever, audiobooks.
Ooh,
never been a big audiobooker, but actually, I know you're a fan of James Lee Burke, Jen.
I am.
As I recall, from like doing research for a panel interview 6 years ago or something. I remember you reading. So yeah, I've listened to a couple of James Lee Burke books. Usually I get too impatient with audiobooks because I don't like listening to them sped up. And if you listen to them at normal speed and you're really engaged, especially in a plot-driven story, I just get impatient and end up, you know, buying the book again and in a book form and reading it quicker that way. But if I'm actually walking every day and listening to every day, it feels nice and natural.
I will say I did listen to James Lee Burke audiobooks when I had eye surgery. And is it still the same actor with that accent, that Southern accent?
The new guy is Will Patton, who's an actor you'd probably recognize, actually. But there was a guy before who I actually looked him up because I find him really good. He does the main detective character with not much of an accent.
Yeah.
But he does different little Southern accents for everybody else quite well. And I looked him up and he was actually an actor who was a screen actor for a long time. Lost a leg to diabetes. Started doing more audiobooks. Lost another leg in a car accident that was not his fault. But yeah, kept his audiobook career going. He's deceased now. I wish I could remember his name, but he does the early Dave Robichaud, James Cooper audiobooks, if you want
to
look them up.
I used to listen to those. Yeah, I did listen to those, and he was great. Mm-hmm. Like, his voice was, like, if he was still alive, he should definitely have done that Calm app, you know, the one that Matthew McConaughey does.
Yeah, that's a good idea. He has like the kind of gentle, noble authority that character needs, which is really hard to pull off without just sounding silly. He was a great actor, I think. I think Will Patton is also very good too. He does Stephen King's audiobooks and stuff. He's qualified.
Well, for friends of the podcast, if you don't know, Naman and I first met doing a panel. I think it was we were at the Fold, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Shout out to JL Richardson, also friend of the podcast. And we did a panel on like crime in fiction. Was it crime in fiction?
Yeah, I was just hosting that one.
Yeah.
It was before I don't think it had any books out at that point. So it was you and Mayank Bhatt and Katharina Vermette. Aww. So like really different writers, really different books. It was actually a very good panel.
It was a fun time. I had a good time. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Should we talk, by the way, when Dina and I were texting each other about a hero of our time, I think one of my first texts was, oh my God, Olivia, I can't.
Very good.
Yeah, yes. I would say that was the first text you sent. Absolutely.
That's when I was on CBC, a lot of people who texted it was their Sunday magazine show. A lot of people who interacted with it on social media were kept on discussing what the takeaway from the book was, and like as though it could be made into like a sort of business case, and like this is how we can fix diversity programs, which is of course not the point of the book. But I think Olivia, I Can't is a good takeaway from that book.
Well, you know what? Why don't I just ask you then? Because how do you? I'm so interested in the construction of her as a character. So when you sat down, so for me, like I read her and I'm like, she's a high concept character. Like I felt like I would have had to sit down for months to come up with her. So like, how did you even approach that? Did you say, I want a character who does this, this, and this, or do I want a character? I want a character that like embodies these qualities. Like, I'm just curious what your process was like to make her, because she's really unforgettable. Like, she scares me. I think I'm going to have nightmares.
I think embodies these qualities. That approach, I think, is probably closest. I was definitely thinking of a few like specific, the two sort of famous people I would be thinking of would be Elizabeth Holmes, of course,
yes,
of Theranos, and Belle Gibson, who's a slightly more obscure figure, but she was a wellness influencer in Australia. I urge you two to look her up after, but I don't want to tell you too much about her on the podcast because it might give away a certain twist in the book, which I really like. But then also just people who have annoyed me throughout my career, of course, online and in my real life, just embodiments of different kinds of, I guess, soft power and people who are really good at manipulating initiatives and various progressive movements into rising to power, even though those movements don't really seem to showcase, in this case, Olivia being a white woman. It's definitely people who are good at sort of getting in on a movement and making it about themselves. I thought that, but I did initially conceive her as being more the villain of the book, even though the title A Hero of Our Time came early. I borrowed it from Lermontov, and that book is so clearly about how there aren't heroes in novels if you're going to write a realistic novel. So I realized I'd made a mistake. Like, I can't have Olivia just be a straight up villain, because that makes my protagonist so much more uncomplicatedly good. He has to be at least as kind of gross as she is. So she became a lot more mysterious to me as she became mysterious to my characters narrating the book. And I think that helped her become so much better, because there's all these complexities that are hinted at and never really seen through, but they're there.
No, I was just going to say that the twist about Olivia, though, I'm not going to reveal it, but I just about fell off my sofa.
Oh, I was going to say, I really liked, too, the way that character existed in the book and often would enter a scene with almost these, I kept thinking, like, horror tropes. Like, you're at a bar and she just appears and you're like, who is this specter human that keeps, you know, showing up, when you think you have a moment's peace or a moment to yourself, and you can't have that. Like, there is no way to catch your breath in those moments. It's like the surveillance of that character was very fascinating to me as well.
Yeah, that was important to me. Like, even though he's the main character, Osman, is very self-critical, he also purports to be in control of situations so often. So having her just, you know, pop up and destabilize things time and again was a great pleasure for me as a writer. But also, I think a good reflection of, especially if you think about along career lines, this is so much a book about work. When you have a career path set out for yourself and things seem to be going well, the people who tend to imbalance you or the situations that come up and set you back a couple of years tend to be just surprises to you, but you realize they have been the result of careful planning by other parties for years.
Yeah, and also those things tie into the comedic aspects of the book because they create those moments of surprise, which is like a comedic element, and the moments of tension, which are also comedic. So that brings me to, of course, Jen probably knows, I want to talk so much about the comedic and satirical aspects of this book, because these are the things I like to obsess over. And I feel like I scream laughed a few times while I was reading, because there were just moments where that was like the only appropriate way to react. And
Rosie's laughing right now. Sorry.
Yeah, Rosie, this is how she laughs. Well, it's funny because I was going to say the humor in the novel is biting, which Rosie could do. But I also like that humor plays a role in the narrative as well. Mm-hmm. We're introduced to the novel through that first scene is about a joke that then kind of takes us into the novel. So I guess overall, if we could just talk about like why it was important for you to have humor in this book and how you approached that aspect.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad that you led with comedy instead of satire, because I've always thought of it more as social comedy than satire. I think also part of that is maybe just my own inner marketer, because satire immediately strikes a lot of people as like, that's going to be boring and smart, which was the last thing I wanted to do. I wanted this to be exciting and stupid before it was smart at all. And I think that, yeah, it opens with a joke, as you say. He uses this sort of like hack shtick joke at business situations all the time. And he talks about it being hijacked from him and taken by Olivia, who turns out to be this sort of villain of the book. But also it's, the entire narrative voice of the book is told in like this very acrid, self-hating, humorous tone, and jokes sort of inform the entire view of like everything you're seeing is lensed through this sort of, you know, very acid humor. And that to me is always, that's part of how I see the world, is really through a humorous lens. It's a way of interpreting reality. So it's also a way of expressing reality. That's what I wanted the book's humor to do. And I've sort of tripped into being boring and smart about it. But mainly, I think I wanted to, modern life is so indigestible and awful. And I wanted humor not to distract from that, but to plunge deeply into how like unpleasant the world and dealing with it is. And so to me, the jokes are never a distraction. And I think you've agreed with that. Like, it actually pulls you deeper into the book and you find yourself, you know, uncomfortably laughing at, whether it's something that's, you know, violently against your own beliefs in terms of social justice, or if it's something that you find so strikingly true about unfairness in the world. I think each of those laughs kind of draw you deeper into, you know, the head of our character, Osman, who says like his head is such an unpleasant place to be. And I think that's actually, people who've liked the book and people who've hated the book have kind of shared this reaction of how it can be unpleasant to be in this vacuum of this person's negative. My friend David Hollingshead called it like a pall. Like, the narrative voice is sort of a pall over the novel as well. And so my attempt, whether I, you know, succeeded or not, was to try to make the funniness that goes along with that like sort of undertow of sadness enough to sort of like keep you treading water. But I don't know if it works. I don't know if it works.
Well, I mean, I would say that it does. Like, when I'm reading Osman, the thing that I absorb most about him as a protagonist is this is it a body dysmorphia, how he feels about himself and his physical appearance? Yeah, like that's how, where I was, what I was like as a reader, I'm like, oh my gosh, he hates himself so much in his physical appearance. He's always talking about how he's made his shirts disgusting. And he's always like, you know, worried about the buttons on his shirt and he's worried about what he looks like. And then that was funny, but also deeply sad because that the idea of that, because I think there is at some point where we realize as readers, he's not as disgusting as he thinks he is. Right. Mm-hmm. And we realize this and it's both of those things. And you know what it reminds me of, Niven, and this is so silly. It was one of the notes I wrote in the margins is like, this book reminds me of Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, like this kind of acid comedy, but there's a lot of sadness there too, because there's tragedy, obviously people's hearts break, and all of that stuff. And the comedy for me is grounded, and I'll tell you, is that it felt like I was reading a book that sounded like the way people of color talk to each other when there's no white people in the room. And that to me was uniquely hilarious.
I think you've married the two things that I really wanted to do with the body stuff there. I always do use dysmorphic as shorthand when I'm just talking about the book for how he perceives his body. But what that really contains is that he's unable to see himself or think about himself other than as he thinks he's looked at. And you could easily spin that as being like, that's how he's looked at in the sort of white liberal world / tech world where he has to do his work, where of course there are a lot of people of color, especially South Asian and Asian people of color around him, but he still feels that he's not quite like them. And he's never quite himself at all. He's so dislocated from his own identity, and he uses his confusion about his own body as a way of sort of expressing that to himself, that he doesn't even know what he looks like anymore, but he's very uncomfortable with it. But I shy away from ever, like, I'd never like write down that he's dysmorphic, because it's a bit like the Peril Segal essay about trauma. Like, trauma is such a real thing. It's informed so many lives. It's informed a lot of our fiction, but dysmorphia is a real thing, and it's a real lived experience for so many people who have this terrible struggle. But I feel like if you nail down a character's the way he perceives himself to a certain psychological set of conditions, you've actually narrowed the lens. So I don't actually think he is dysmorphic himself, but I'll shorthand it as dysmorphic anytime, so I don't have to talk for 3 minutes like I just did.
Can I just quickly, when you were writing it, when I say it's like how people of color talk to each other when there's no white people in the room, was that even like a thought for you? Because I was like, when I was reading it, I said this to my partner who's a white person, and I'm like, this is what we sound like when you're not around.
Absolutely. Like, and also I think there's a certain like crossing racial lines, like we're all safe here conversation that you have. Like, I'm sure that when the mics are off, you and Dina have like conversations that would destroy your careers in 2 minutes if you were ever on camera, right? Like, there's a certain kind of, you know, we feel safe about talking across because we know each other. There's a familiarity here. We can make all the jokes that we can't on the podcast or in certain rooms, because you know all the context I'm bringing to this, and I know all of your context. So I wanted to do that, like, because who do you have more context with than yourself? So he's talking to himself this whole novel, and then as you realize, he's attempting to write something, and he's also speaking to his mother, but in a way that he's never spoken to her before. So I wanted to bring this sort of kind of a violent honesty that mostly has to do with friendship in my life to the book, but in his case, he has no friends. So the only place he can bring it to is this book.
Yeah, I had so many heartbreaking feelings about I'm sure lots of people did. Jen and I talked about this too, like the ending and the ideas that we can have about relationships and how they can exist and end and move. But anyway, that final scene with Osmond and his mother was so gutting and also felt so right. It was just narratively, I was like, oh, of course this is, you know, where we're leading. And it also made me think about the way we tell stories and lies are stories, and we do that to move through life, and we see it in so many different ways in this book. So I wonder if we can talk about lies and story in this novel and the various ways they're used and sort of the intention behind that.
Sure. Yeah, one of my very smart early readers said, like, it is, he wanted to point out to me that he hoped that it was on purpose that everybody was so pathologically deceptive in terms of how they viewed themselves and portrayed themselves to other people in the book, because it's not strictly realistic. For this number of people in a family and a small group of people at work and in friendships, for all of them to have this much deception going on, it's not quite realistic. But it was definitely an artistic choice, because I did want to think about this sort of making of the self as story, in not in like a, I find so much of the way that that's expressed in modern novels, especially by people of color, is a sort of triumphant, I'm making my own story. I'm remaking myself. I'm not like my parents. I'm not like my peers. I am myself. I'm telling the story of myself by telling my story, and therefore I'm going to become this new kind of person. I wanted to make that into something quite grim, and to talk about how lying and storytelling are very close to each other, and also that they're not just like an innovation of people of color who are born here. Like, they're a big part of immigration stories, and of course always have been, you know, changing last names, and not just that, but not always wanting to go back to where one came from or to long for it, but to sort of violently erase that part of one's past. And yeah, pointing to that last scene with his mother, that's interesting, because more than a few people who passed on the book, which thankfully was taken by the perfect editor, but you know, you hear from your agent like things that come up in terms of people who didn't respond to the book. That scene at the end with his mother was often pointed out as like, this is such a great emotional scene and it's so honest. I wish there was more of this in the book, which was to me a sign of the book's success, because leading up to this like quite emotional and nakedly honest scene that cannot be interpreted any other way than what you're presented with on the page, that's an effect that you can't get without 240 pages of the other stuff before it. So to me, it was both a sign that the editors were right, that this is going to have a hard time hooking a certain kind of reader who wants a certain kind of immediately emotionally striking work that has honesty in it, a sincerity to engage from the beginning, and that it was artistically what I wanted, successful. Like, it was successful in that sense of when you lead up to this moment of sincerity, which I have to say has made people sadder than I thought it was, because to me it's still more funny than sad. But yes, it was the ultimate sort of, it's both like a, almost like a cheap suspense writer's reveal in terms of like this thing that you've thought was one way, wasn't another way. Although there was certainly clues planted earlier on in scenes with his mother that like, this is exactly what it could be. But it does lead to this sort of like stripped down naked sincerity. And then the very last scene you have is like him alone, which to me is in its own way, quite a happy ending, because it's the only way in which he could continue to exist with any sort of happiness.
So that scene is successful because structurally it's where it's supposed to be, and that emotional beat is supposed to be there, but also because it is doing all these very, it's still outrageous. Like, I think a lot of this book is outrageous, which is part of the reason why I really love it. Like, I love writers going to an outrageous place. Thrills me, makes me happy. But imagine your mother says that to you and you're just like, excuse me?
Yeah.
I could really picture that in sort of the, it felt very, this is going to be a prestige adaptation that's going to happen. And I could see that scene. So I hope that happens, that frankly. Great. I really need that to happen. Yeah. I want it to happen, but it was, that really, I mean, I thought about it throughout the book while I was reading it, but at that scene, I was like, yeah, I can see this. Like, this is going to be a great scene. I can't wait till everyone gets to enjoy it on HBO Max. Anyway, Jen, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, as a mom myself, I read that scene and I felt so much freedom for his mom.
Yeah. Like, when people ask me why I don't have kids, and I'm like, because I would a doll's house them, and that's why I don't have them. So I just need to be honest about the situation. That's what's happening.
Can I ask, Naban, I'm really curious about dialogue. I'm such a craft nerd. There is a lot, your dialogue here does a lot of work. Like, it does a lot of that sort of propulsion of plot. It does a lot of like backstory, character development. It does all of those things. And it reminds me of the way stage plays are often written with the dialogue doing pretty much all of the work other than what the actors are doing across the stage. So I want to know, how do you write dialogue naturally? Because I hate dialogue. I'm really bad at it. So this is why I'm so fascinated with, like, is that the way stories come out of you?
If I had like one natural talent in writing, it would be dialogue, I think. Like, that was the one thing that when I started and was an especially terrible writer, that was the one thing that was kind of like, oh, this does sound a bit like how people talk. But in this book, people don't talk how people talk. So I wasn't able to sort of draw on what I was kind of good at, except in his narrative voice. When he's being internal, that sounds a bit more like natural speech almost. But I think I'll go to influence for to explain a bit like where I got the way they talked. And it would be Don DeLillo and Saul Bellow, where you get these, but Don DeLillo especially probably, where you get these really idea-packed, long, multi-clausal sentences. Again, not how people talk, but they are often how you remember like an extremely packed conversation that you had with someone that you're discussing something very important with. All these ideas, all these jokes become compressed, and they sort of become all something that that other person said to you, as opposed to things that you said in discussion quickly in exchange. So I had to sort of give myself permission to not be realist in my dialogue in this, because I thought that that was the best way to sort of recall the story from someone who's so often dishonest with himself and with the reader. I think reading Players by Don DeLillo, which is by no means one of his better books, made me feel so much more comfortable about it, because the book still works, even though people are not talking at all the way they should talk. And the Bellow part of it is, I mean, he also has these really twisting and unrealistic conversations that somehow still feel very salt of the earth and sort of true to the like immigrant descended people that are having the discussions. So often, like in terms of influence, I'm actually looking for comfort. Like, is this okay? Can I get away with this? And those are sort of the people who made me feel okay about the way the dialogue went in this.
I love it when I read something and I can see that this particular element of this book has a point, right? So I read your dialogue and I'm like, well, they're not supposed to sound like they're actually talking to each other. There is a point to it. And I was so fascinated with that decision. It reminds me actually of the dialogue in Flannery O'Connor stories also, because it's not, that's not how people talk. And that's not the point.
Yeah.
And you know, so when I was reading it, I'm like, oh no, Ben wants me to get somewhere with this. And I'm going to join him on this journey. But it was like fascinating to me, particularly, well, it's Osman and Nina when they're talking together, that there's so much of that. And I am like, and I think there's a point in the book where Nina actually says, there are reasons when I talk to you that I'm mean to you. She says something like that to him, I think.
She also like she talks about how speaking to him is like speaking to nobody, I believe, like that it's sort of like, it's like looking into a mirror, it's a reflection. And that's, I think, sort of an indication as well that he doesn't really listen to her that well. Like he extracts information from her, but so much of what he purports to you, the reader, that she's saying is probably stuff that he's thinking. Like he's taking bits of information from her and sort of dressing it up and, well, this is how I'd approach it. Which is why he can't really ever be, you know, with her in the many senses that he's not with her in the book. It's because he doesn't actually have this deep sense of caring for her and consideration and thought about her that he thinks he does.
No.
He's barely listening to her.
That's why he only spends a responsible 10 minutes between her legs. Which is my favorite line in the whole book, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Is that your favorite line?
Yeah. It's hilarious.
I feel like this book is full of great quotable lines like that. Like I kept coming back to it again early in the book. There are so many great lines, but when he says, the woman who pulled my spine out and dangled it from the stage like Predator. And it's just like, it's so over the top. It's so great. But also that's when we are thinking about ourselves and the way we're perceived and the way something has happened to us and we're recounting it. That's how we're feeling. We're like being, we are being dramatic.
And that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Osmond doesn't think he's dramatic, but he's extremely dramatic.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, and he clothes that in like in these sort of like little jokes, but he really does feel exactly that way. He feels this moment that really few people around him noticed and certainly fewer cared about is the most exposing thing you could possibly imagine.
And like it sets off the whole novel. It sets this off and you're just like, oh boy, hold on to your hats. Here we go. Like we're getting on the roller coaster and Osmond is taking us on that roller coaster.
Yeah. And I think it needs the sort of the craft thinking there, like it needs those like overdramatic high points to sort of, if you're less willing, for example, to engage with the dialogue than Jen was, maybe that those big high story points will be like, okay, I'm going to read through this Don DeLillo bullshit and get to actually something else happening in the story. That's sort of, it's not exactly service to that reader, but I feel it's service to the novel as like an overall artwork is making sure you have these sort of overstated operatic moments for the narrator that hopefully come through to the readers being that dramatic, just so the more idea dense stuff is at least digestible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've talked about dialogue, but I think structure overall in this book is just, it's done so well. The use of that POV, of course, the voice, and the way it unraveled, it felt like a restructuring of a narrative as we proceed to get deeper and deeper into Osmond's head, his life, his being. And as he, you know, discovered all these things about himself, but also the people around him and his life. And I guess I want to know sort of, again, going back to that craft nerd stuff, like how do you organize a novel like this? Because it also addresses all of these different things, you know, there's cultural commentary, friendships, relationships, love, family, workplace shit, cultural relevancy, higher ed, like there's all these things within this, in this book. So yeah. How do you, like behind the scenes, what are you doing?
I mean, the organizing certainly came later. There isn't exactly first draft writing in here, but there are certainly like three or four page sections that seem, anything that seems particularly ranty is probably something that I did actually write very quickly and potentially out of sequence. There is a lot, and I think that actually the hard thing was to anchor that to the story later on when I was reorganizing things. Another big organizational thing that I remember is all the scenes are so intimate and small until the very last one. The last big one, the climax at the tech conference, and that was something I felt just so exhausted in approaching of like how I'm going to write this big crowd scene. I just kept on getting in my own way, not thinking of like, well, you're actually just writing about the stage because the audience has always just been a faceless audience. It is in the opening scenes of the novel, and it makes sense for this novel to have a faceless audience because the guy telling it doesn't really see the faces of the people around him, except the ones he's in direct combat with. But I thought that organizing it in terms of like these large but small scale scenes, like there's actually not that many. What my thrillers have probably what they could be broken down into like 60 to 100 scenes. I feel like this one has like 15 scenes in it. That can't possibly be right, but it has very few actually, like it feels like a 6-chapter novel almost. So I think that was something I did so I could sort of wrestle all of the ideas and all of the different time frames and the things that he learns into these very limited physical spaces. Like so much of what we learn about his father happens when he's like sitting at his kitchen table or walking to the other apartment he owns. And I felt that by having these really limited physical spaces and being really hard on myself to make sure like this doesn't seem just like a flashback, you're going to contextualize it, you're going to make sure that this scene that we see in the past is completely arresting. And then when the reader comes back to the present, it's going to seem like almost jarring because that other scene was so completely rendered. Just so it was still, you know, following the rule. I very loosely follow the show don't tell rule, just to make sure that the reader was still there and that I wasn't just being easy on myself and dumping in idea stuff. So that was it. That just certainly that second draft and third draft and fourth draft look at if this also applies to the dialogue. Am I just being easy on myself? Am I just saying like, well, look, it's technique, so it's fine. It's fine to tell the story this way. You don't have to build in a new scene for this. And it felt finished when both me and my editor, Haley Cunningham, agreed like, okay, this can answer, you can successfully answer these questions, and said like, no, you weren't cheating.
It's okay to cheat though, if you have to.
Sure. Yes. I cheat my way through first drafts all the time and then see if I have to actually be hard on them. Yeah.
I want to ask you a real quick question about clothing, because I always notice clothing. So the most recent podcast guest we had on, who I thought also was really good at clothing, was Casey Plett. And I got it here too, which is especially when Olivia just shows up and she's always wearing the exact right thing for the moment. And I found that so creepy. How do you know what the exact right thing is for any moment? And then Osman's sort of struggle with his clothing. He really struggles with his clothing. And did you, like, I'm curious, like, is this like a through line for you writing in general, or is it specific like to this book, the clothing and the way people appear or want to appear to other people?
I think it is a through line in general, but there have been works that I've forced it into where it hasn't really, it's often how I feel my way into character. Chris Burton actually pointed this out in a short story I sent him, where there were a lot of clothing descriptions that were totally unnecessary and actually weren't advancing anything or giving the reader any insight. And it's one of those things that'll happen in a short story. Like, you'll often write it from the perspective of the wrong character or spend many pages with a character who isn't supposed to be the main character. And you only realize that at the end. But it's always been something that I've used to sort of feel my way into character, even though I'm not any sort of, I don't have style. I don't have like, I try to look my age appropriately, and that's about it. But in terms of these characters in this world of appearances, it really is so relevant. My brief jobs that I've had in tech as well, one of the first things that really leaps out at you is the casualness standards for men and women in those offices and how wildly different they are. Like, I'm wearing right now a black jeans and a Metallica sweatshirt. This would be a cool and interesting outfit in tech. And I could go to a meeting with the CEO of Google dressed like this, and it would actually be something interesting, I feel. If a woman wore this same thing, maybe it would work as a vastly daring move, but I think she'd probably lose her job somewhere along the way into that room. Like the pressure to wear the right thing, but not have it be too elegant and not have it be too casual. It's such a tightrope, and it's an interesting tightrope that I never have and never will have to walk. So that was relevant to this story. And I think I'm glad that the amount of calculations that I did shows up in the book. It's sometimes very deliberate. Like Osman thinks about what like New Order t-shirt or whatever Nina will decide to wear to make the white like venture capitalist that she's meeting feel comfortable with her ethnicity. Like if you see a Persian girl wearing a New Order shirt, you're like, oh, okay, I'm comfortable here. Whereas if you see an Iranian woman wearing traditional garb, whatever that may be in your mind, you don't feel comfortable perhaps if you're this white venture capitalist in New York. It's another race paralleling shell, just like Osman's body in the book.
I mean, I wear my Bob Ross t-shirt to put people at ease. It's fine.
It does. I'm sure it does.
Let's talk a little bit about that setting then, this like corporate tech world, which of course I know nothing about. So it is so fascinating to me. But as you said earlier in the episode, you know, you were taking from some real world experiences for both yourself and culturally, the Elizabeth Holmes of it all. So it felt like the perfect setting for sort of everything you were trying to do. But I guess I want to know, I guess I'm just interested in the choice and how you wanted and what you wanted to explore about that, that world and that environment.
If you're going to write about power and culture and our ideas of progress now, it's just unignorable. Tech is just impossible to ignore. And the jobs I had were always tech adjacent, that I worked in like sort of social media advertising world for a little while. So I didn't want to go so deep into the world of what it's like to work at a tech company that it would reveal that I'd never actually worked in the internals of it. But I certainly, so I was really dealing more with the perception, the magic of how like tech equals progress, no matter what. And that if you use that sort of logic in the right rooms, like the admin rooms of, at colleges, when you're selling your product, it seems retrograde to disagree with it. That one moment that came back to me over and over while I was reading this was so insignificant, but I was waiting for the, bus at 16th and Ash in Vancouver during a teacher strike some years ago. And it, and a guy, you know, as they do, just started talking to me, some lonely person who I didn't want to have a conversation with. And he's saying, "What do you think about the strike?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, I'm pro-union. The teachers have some reasonable requests." And he just said, "iPads, man." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "They just keep on wanting new textbooks. All these kids need is iPads, man." And I was like, "Yeah, that's it. That's an interesting perspective," which is something I say a lot to sort of stop these conversations. But that to me, that's just so revelatory, because I think that, you know, he was just some rube on the street, but I could easily see like an upper level admin person also sharing this because they don't actually think through, you know, the product cost of an iPad or what makes it superior to a textbook and not just an infinite distraction machine for in this case, elementary school and high school kids. And in the case of my book, university people. I thought that if you're going to write also just about the sort of sea change happening in education and in the valuing of like so much of this book is also about, you know, the death of the book and everything I care about. There's so many like novels dying in this book, and even his own ability to read, the protagonist is sort of departing him. Tech is just all over that. And that's the, I don't think of it as a sad novel, but it's not an optimistic novel in terms of what progress has led us to.
Ugh. And I mean, right now with everything, it just felt also so relevant because of everything higher ed is dealing with in terms of pivoting to digital and how there are so many issues with like people need IT help with every aspect of the, you know, it's not just as easy as doing whatever. Oh, here's an ebook. And it's like, no, everything is connected to something else. There's so much more.
That's right.
Around all this.
And that was actually, that was an early nightmare of this book, is that, you know, when I was three quarters through is when the pandemic started, three quarters through the first draft. So my like really her clever coup, Olivia's, is has to do with remote learning and getting a college to adopt it as though it's going to be a bold new innovation before anybody else does it. Let's just voluntarily do an entire semester remotely. At the time that I wrote that, this, you know, not everybody in the entire world was doing a semester remotely. So I had to, that's when I realized like, you know, you're actually going to have to ground this in a certain month and in a certain year in order to retain not just her forward thinkingness, which by the way, was also my forward thinkingness, and I'll never get credit for it.
Yeah,
that
rude.
These demons were going to take advantage of this moment. Yeah. But yes, I really didn't want to write something that was going to end up in a pandemic novels list. So I had to use the pandemic just enough to sort of say like, this is somebody who was really predictive and their result for it is billions of dollars, because indeed this did happen to the whole world. And guess what? Now international students will be able to go to, you know, Harvard remotely, I'm sure, in a couple of years and pay exorbitant international fees.
Absolutely.
And they can expand those classes enormously. Yep. And it's all for a bottom line, of course.
I taught online for years, right? Before the pandemic? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exclusively, mm-hmm. exclusively online. So when I was reading this book, I'm like, we're looking at you, Canvas.
Good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the philosophy hopefully isn't so retrograde that it denies how useful and progressive tech can be in the classroom. It's just when it just becomes inevitable that when the profit, the idea of enormous profit and rising profit comes into play, and the idea that the classroom, the physical classroom, could be made a thing of the past, that's just an enormous dollar sign to the people who now run universities.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a capitalist pursuit for sure. And I mean, we've known this, you know, the corporate university has been fucking around for a long time. So.
Absolutely.
I have a very, very important question for you.
Okay.
Please tell us about your cat.
Oh yeah. Moberly. He's a good cat. He's white and gray. We've had him for 2 years now, I guess. Yeah. He's probably not that well socialized. He's very afraid whenever the occasional time we have, he's more afraid of male visitors than women. But yeah, he's been a real boon to have around. Unlike my last cat, he's more of a clingy, babyish animal. So sometimes I miss, my old cat Buddy was much more like a Heath Ledger and Brokeback Mountain type. He was great to have around. So I miss him.
God, I just like that your cat is making a lot of appearances online. It's it also delights me to get to see your cat, your beautiful cat.
Okay, sorry. As soon as you said Heath Ledger and Brokeback Mountain, all I could see was this cat sadly eating a piece of pie by himself in a diner.
I was picturing the cat opening a little closet and there's a shirt hanging in there. It's like a little, take a little sniff.
That's more or less, let's see. I have that. Right here.
Look, I have the shirt. Desk. Oh, okay.
Oh, his collar. That's his collar. That He's is dead. So sweet.
He was a good guy. Yeah. Yeah. Especially, not being. It was an important relationship when I was here and like alone for years. And, I had my roommate, of course, and lots of fine friends, but I didn't think I'd ever become so dependent on a house pet. I sure did.
I really got to live vicariously through everyone else. One day Vancouver is going to say everyone can have 10 cats and I'm going to have so many cats.
Yeah. It's a silly law.
It's so ridiculous. Yeah. I don't know, Jen, if you saw, but a couple of weeks ago they were trying to get someone to adopt a dog and a cat together that were best friends. And mm-hmm. I really, really wanted them to. I was like, why can't these beautiful creatures come live with me?
I see so many adoption things because I follow all the rescues online because I'm insane. And I can't have another dog. My house is small. Rosie's kind of an asshole. I cannot have another dog. Yeah. Or I could probably get a cat. We've considered it. Rosie likes cats and she likes rabbits. She does
love cats.
Yeah. I'm like, how many creatures am I supposed to be responsible for? Like, I'm done. I'm
Listen,
out.
Listen, I'll come help you anytime.
Okay.
You know me. I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm ready. Jen, are you ready for Jen's Emotion Corner?
I'm ready. Okay, I don't know if Ben's ready.
I mean, I hope so. Okay, I'm going to start timing you. So Jen will be emotional now for 1 minute, and your time starts now.
Okay, so this is the worst my mental health has felt in years. Let's everybody celebrate how we're all unraveling. Truly, I am not the only one. I think that I am unraveling in ways that I see like really famous people also publicly unraveling. So that makes me feel a bit better. I spend a lot of time like thinking, especially right now, that I'm like not good enough and it's stupid to like try to be better. And why am I writing this book anyway? Will anyone read this? Nobody likes me, you know, those sorts of things. And it's these old sort of intrusive thoughts that I think nobody ever wants. And what's really upsetting now is that those old coping mechanisms, and by old, I mean beginning of the pandemic coping mechanisms from like, 1 or 2 years ago are no longer really working. Like I can only watch Yellow Jackets for so long before it just starts to really depress me. And like the reality of life just kind of like sinks in. I can't be baking bread. So what do? Right. So the only thing I can really say is I really try to celebrate my morning coffee, and I spend a lot of time trolling Gwyneth Paltrow and Ben Mulrooney online. And that makes me feel alive. And then I just wrote here, there's one more note, which is to say all bets are off. You do what you have to do, even if it's not healthy, air quotes, or productive, because trolling Gwyneth Paltrow isn't particularly productive for me. And yet I persist.
I got to be honest. It sounds pretty healthy to me to troll her. So I think it sounds great.
You know, I have a whole chapter about hating Gwyneth Paltrow in my new book coming out, also with McClellan and Stewart. And I'm quite serious. You have an editor that allows you to write 30 pages on why you hate Gwyneth Paltrow. You better keep that editor for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's a precious commodity.
So, Dina, are you ready for your rage minute, though?
Yeah, I'm ready. Hold on. I'm not ready. I lied. Okay.
Okay, ready? Go.
Yeah. Okay, Freedom Convoy shit heels. My phone acting like I care about how much screen time I've accumulated. I don't. Too many people I love are sick, or their loved ones are sick, and it's fucking horrible. Also, healthcare being tied to employment is bullshit. Also, Starbucks discontinued the oat fudge bar, the best thing on the menu of anything those suckers make. I keep getting food stuck in the gummy hole where my tooth used to be, and I just feel like an absolute filth monster every single time. I'm disgusting. Too many crypto bots following me on Instagram. Leave at Delbotchery alone. I will not be participating. Celebrities and their hideous monkey NFTs. I don't want to look at that. Please be more interesting. Your job is to do entertaining stuff, and tabloids need better content. I haven't seen Jen in so long, and I hate that. And the force of my daily rage definitely popped me a brand new hemorrhoid, which I'm also pretty rage-filled about. So yeah, send me some soothing witch hazel in like a gallon bucket.
Also, so, we're going to make a new NFT. It's not going to be monkeys. I don't know what we're going to do.
It's going to be a hemorrhoid NFT.
We're just going to do what the people want.
Listen, everyone gets hemorrhoids, so we can monetize that.
Does Gwyneth Paltrow have a cure for hemorrhoids? She must.
She probably, I mean, I'm sure she says that she does. She probably has an NFT as well. Maybe multiple.
She did post. She did post an NFT, didn't she? It was like 2 days ago, 3 days ago.
I missed it.
I saw it was a monkey, wasn't it? Yeah, never mind. I could be wrong.
It's an ape. It's one of those ape ones.
Yeah.
I don't want to look at them.
Don't want to look them. At them.
I'm not going to look at them. I only want to look at the two of you and other things and people that I like. I don't want to look at that. Well, this was a really great episode. Thank you so much for talking to us. Is there anywhere on the internet where people can find you, get your book?
Books should be available everywhere in Canada, at least. It's on Twitter. I'm at Naben Ruthnam. But yes, please, for God's sakes, buy the book. It's important because I write so many different kinds of things, but this is probably the thing that's most precious to me. And the next literary novel I want to write is a vast and improbable one. And the idea of getting someone to offer me money to write it is ridiculous. So the better this one does, the less ridiculous that becomes.
Okay, and please, I think it's also, a good please book. Help us get another novel from Naben, because this one is great and we want to read another one. So don't be jerks, go buy it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And you can find us at cantlit.ca, at cantlit on Twitter. You can subscribe, you can like us, you can give us 5 stars so that more people will listen to this podcast. And maybe those people will also buy the book. So you're spreading the love.
Rosie's barking
is also
to tell us.
Spreading the love.
I don't know who walks by the house. I'm sorry.
I don't know either. Something's going on.
She sounds like a good dog. I like her.
She's a good dog. She's an asshole, but that's okay. I'm okay with that.
No, she's absolutely incredible. She's loyal and fierce. And she has a weird overbite. No, underbite.
Ah, yes. I like that.
Yeah. It's really cute.
She's very vain about her teeth.
Yeah. And she has one jacket that she likes to wear.
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah.
Which one are you talking about?
Her red jacket.
Oh, she has the red one?
Yeah.
Okay, because I also have a yellow one with a hood that she only wears at Halloween because she's always Georgie from It. So I kind
of... Pretty good.
Wait, why can't... You should be dressing up like Pennywise next year. Come on.
Yeah, maybe I'll be Pennywise. She'll be Georgie and, like, I don't know who Oscar is. We'll figure it out.
He's a balloon.
Yeah! Oh, he's just a balloon.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Just like a big... That would be a fun costume. Anyway, come back to me in a few months and I'll remind you of this costume. So, Nipen, we have one question left for you. What can't you with?
Well, I'm not going to use that expression because I dislike it. But I've had it with writers who don't read any books and who don't read any books into the past and who look at me like I'm not being decolonial enough if I read a book from 1950. It's surprisingly common.
Yeah.
There we go. That's my unfun, but frankly, it does enrage me a lot.
Answer. I like it.
Good.
Every
good.
Summer, I like to read... a mid-century novel. Awesome. I like to just very like, good. Yeah, it's like the beach read that isn't a beach read. It's the perfect, I love it. Yeah. I want to get skin cancer while I'm reading Mary McCarthy's The Group, and that's just who I am, you know?
That's a strange coincidence. Richard Priya is reading Mary McCarthy's The Group right now.
Oh, really? I was really into it.
I read Norman Mailer's unkind review of that a few months ago.
Oh.
Just not him at his best. He's very incorrect about it, and it's not even that funny.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're going to be a jackass about something, you at least have to be entertaining and funny about it.
Which he was actually great at often, and in this case, he really missed the mark entirely. Yeah,
that is unfortunate. Jen, do you have a favorite mid-century novel?
You know what it is that, and Naben mentioned, I like Endgame by Don DeLillo. That's my favorite.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
It's a good one.
I love Don DeLillo. One of the reasons I was like, I really got to get fiction published was so that my book would be next to Don DeLillo's on the shelf. Because our names are so close.
We're right
and I was
there.
Like, this is the best. Yeah. Del Bucchi and DeLillo finally together.
You know
the
what?
Two I Italians love- with the big eyebrows just hanging out. Great.
So my shelf neighbor is Harper Lee.
Of course.
What about you, Naben? Who's your shelf neighbor?
I always forget to check this, but in my head, I'd like to think it's Salman Rushdie.
I think that's
close enough.
It's got to
even boost my sales a bit.
As someone who recently shelved your book in a bookstore,
yeah,
it definitely is. Also,
did you put a staff pick tag on it?
Not yet. I have to order more copies because I think it's already gone. Jen, your book is also often by friend of the podcast, former guest, Nancy Lee.
Also true.
Yes. Also personal friend, the best, which I like. I like when your two books are together on the shelf.
Is when it's shelved correctly. Yeah. Most of the time my books are shelved incorrectly.
Yeah, no, I have so many rules. I love if something's facing out that I don't like, I like to just turn it around, push it back in. I want to put the stuff I like, make it, And I think that I'm being a real asshole. I'm like, man, I'm so cool and tough. Look what I'm doing to these books. It's so stupid. But I do it all the time, like with malice. I'm like, it's terrible. It's so embarrassing. But whatever, you know?
Do they sometimes shelve you S?
They often shelve me under S. Except if the bookseller would only look at the library data on the back side of the title page, they would see that Sook Fong is actually my middle name.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's no like dash or anything.
There's no hyphen. No.
Hyphen, that's the word.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, so like I don't think it's that difficult. If my middle name was Michelle, it would not be an issue, but there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes my books are shelved under B. And whatever, like you can, again, same thing.
Also
you can figure it out. You can just figure it out. Just look it up. It's fine. It's not
a
big deal. It's just two last names. It's fine. Yeah, you know what? It's good. I just like to be mean to my various nemeses, and I like to hide their books.
Diabolical.
Ooh, I'm so evil. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us today, Nabed, and thank you, listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is really nice. It's so great. I mean, I like doing an interview where they haven't read the book because that's its own challenge. Yeah. Where, you know, you have to bring all the information in, but it's so lovely to talk to people who, you know, read it and liked it. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, everybody. We'll see you next month, and it's gonna be springtime. Okay, bye.